loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump said today that he will, quote, almost definitely, unquote, declare a national emergency soon to secure funding for his border wall. He made the comment as he departed today to Texas to meet with Customs and Border Patrol officials and to continue making the case for hardline anti-immigrant policies. Next, the U.S. has accused Russia's Kaspersky lab of working with Russian spies on cyber warfare. But Politico is reporting that Kaspersky actually helped catch an NSA data thief, even though the U.S. had completely missed the theft. Then, the New York Times today issued a correction, a retraction would be more appropriate, to a front-page story yesterday saying that former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort had shared polling data with a Russian contact for passage to a Russian oligarch. That information was not true. Manafort had shared the information for passage to two Ukrainian politicians with whom he had had a business relationship. The true story undercuts any accusation of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. And then it's time again for our weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. And finally, the UK's departure from the European Union is fast approaching. The British Parliament is now conducting the official debate on the Brexit deal ahead of a vote next week. But Prime Minister Theresa May not have the votes necessary to pass the terms of the deal and was dealt a blow when members of her own Conservative Party revolted to help pass a motion limiting her options in the event that the deal is rejected. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the border wall. President Trump said today that he will, quote, almost definitely, unquote, declare a national emergency soon to secure funding for his border wall. He made the comment as he departed today for Texas to meet with Customs and Border Patrol officials and to continue making the case for hardline anti-immigrant policies. We're joined from Tucson, Arizona by Isabel Garcia, co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. Welcome back to the show, Isabel.
Thank you for having me.
Isabel, as we were talking before we went on the air, this is really, I don't know, crazy because it is. It's not a national emergency. It's not a national crisis, but Trump is using that device, and maybe the Democrats will go for it too, just as a way to get the government back open and neither both sides can claim victory. I want to first start with an audio clip from Donald Trump. That's from today. Listen to this. This is before he left for the border.
When during the campaign, I would say Mexico's going to pay for it. Obviously, I never said this and I never meant they're going to write out a check. I said they're going to pay for it. They are. They are paying for it with the incredible deal we made called the United States, Mexico, and Canada, USMCA deal. It's a trade deal. It has to be approved by Congress. It probably will be, other than maybe they even hold that up because they want to have, you know, they want to do as much harm as they can, only because of the 2020 presidential elections.
Okay, you heard our president, Isabel, talking about. He said, when he said during the campaign that Mexico was going to pay for the wall, he didn't say that Mexico was going to pay for the wall. So I don't know. I was a bit confused there. Anyway, that's not the issue now because it's whether U.S. taxpayers are going to pay for the wall.
Yes, as you know, the president is a liar, and he said many times that they were going to pay directly. But be that as it may, I mean, the fact that his supporters are not holding him to that, that we're having to spend money on this boondoggle. But really, I want to get to what's really important here, whether he said that Mexico would pay or not, is that we're living in a really precarious time here all along the border, and not just along the border, obviously, because we have people that should be performing their jobs, and they're not performing their jobs because Trump has everybody hostage for a monstrosity of a wall. You know, he acts as if the border is just a blank slate, like an empty parking lot. How dare he? He doesn't understand that. I mean, Mother Nature has had a role in creating a beautiful environment all along the border that has existed for, as the Tohono O'odham say here, some time immemorial. And we're just going to go and bulldoze. We've caused the harm ourselves. There is no crisis on the border. There is none. I've said it to you before on this very show that there was more migration in 1971 when I graduated from a local high school here than we have now. The lowest migration and yet the highest number ever of Border Patrol agents, customs agents, ATF, ICE, everybody running around in the border, and we are like in a militarized zone. Here I live 56 miles from the border, and yet we are feeling all of it with nobody.
Isabel Garcia, you know, President Barack Obama, when he was a senator in 2006, when this comprehensive immigration reform bill was coming up before the Senate, he came out and the Democrats came out, Hillary Clinton too, came out for a border wall. Then they said, but of course the border wall, and they were willing to pay billions of dollars for a border wall, just as Trump says that right. They were willing to
sure.
do it. But then Obama goes on and says, but this isn't really the solution. The solution is we need to fix the broken immigration system. And then he calls for comprehensive immigration reform. Now, 3 years later, Obama became president of the United States. The House was controlled by the Democrats. The Senate was controlled by the Democrats. Big majorities. They could do whatever they wanted to do. They could have passed comprehensive immigration reform, but they didn't do it. And so here we are again. The Democrats, as Trump said, they were for a wall, but they said hypocritically, we're also for comprehensive immigration reform, but they didn't want to spend a penny of political capital to get there.
That is absolutely correct. While it is true that the Democrats and Obama and all of them have called for walls and fences and more Border Patrol agents, let me tell you, they need to say they were wrong. And secondly, there's a new class in the Congress. And those new congressional people are not going to fall for the old line of comprehensive immigration that means comprehensive militarization of our border, because that's all the Democrats accomplished. They had no reform to our legalization program to legalize, 10 million people or whatever. What they focused on was trying to comply with the Republicans. And at that time, I'm not conceding because we fought them at the time. But remember, at that time, we were at the peak of migration. NAFTA had major implications on rural Mexico, and that's when people were crossing. Here in Tucson, Arizona, the Tucson sector was 1,000 to 2,000 people every single day. So yes, the Democrats were responding to the crisis that they created then with funneling everybody from NAFTA. Then they funneled everybody through Clinton's southern border strategy, funneled them through the border. In other words, they militarized the border, and now they know they made a mistake because this is the wrong way to go. They're not talking about how we stabilize migration. How about talking about root cause, that we have caused major damage in Honduras, which is why we're seeing so many Hondureños. What we've done in El Salvador, not to say Guatemala, we need to understand that the crisis is a humanitarian.
Isabel, I want to play another, we have 2.5 minutes left. This is another Donald Trump speaking earlier today, and then I want to get your response.
I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. The lawyers have so advised me. I'm not prepared to do that yet, but if I have to, I will. I have no doubt about it. I will. I have the absolute right to declare. This was passed by Congress. So when you say it wasn't passed by Congress, it was. Other presidents have used it, some fairly often. I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. I haven't done it yet. I may do it. If this doesn't work out, probably I will do it. I would almost say definitely.
I would almost say definitely. Go ahead, Isabella.
Well, number one is there is absolutely no national emergency. How dare he? The fact of the matter is that he should be called on the carpet to really have brought our military to this border previously to put the wiring up, and now to say that he can declare a national emergency because why? Because they won't do what he wants. You can go to Laredo, you can go to McAllen, you can go to Del Rio, and people are living their lives. There is no national emergency. We have the lowest crime rates all along the southern border. The facts show clearly that the people who more commit crimes are U.S. citizens. I mean, I really feel bad for the family of U.S. Marshal Chase White. He was killed here about a month ago by a white guy with lots of guns. Do you think that Trump would manage to talk about this U.S. Marshal that was killed? Absolutely not. He wants to talk about the poor officer that was gunned down by a guy who was undocumented. That's what he does. He uses scare tactics to scare all of us when the reality is the border is the safest. And let me tell you, how dare people say that the professionals, we should check with the professionals. The Border Patrol not only has a conflict of interest, they love their big fat jobs, and they are, let me tell you, very well paid. But they're murderers. And I'll say this on the air. We cannot trust a murderous agency. And that's all you have to do is look up their history. They've murdered people with impunity. They just finished the trial of declaring him not guilty. That means the Border Patrol has free rein to kill, not to even mention the economic devastation of our border towns here.
And that was the voice of Isabel Garcia, the co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. Isabel joined us from Tucson, Arizona. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The U.S. has accused Russia's Kaspersky Lab of working with Russian spies on cyber warfare. But Politico is reporting that Kaspersky actually helped catch an NSA data thief, even though the U.S. had completely missed that theft. We're joined from Oakland, California by the author of that exclusive article, Kim Zetter. She's a prolific journalist who has contributed to Politico, The Washington Post, The New York Times, CNN, NPR, and other outlets. And she's the author of Countdown to Zero Day, Stuxnet and the Launch of the World's First Digital Weapon. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you.
Kim, your article flies in the face of the narrative that Kaspersky is working with Russian intelligence officials to target the United States. Here in this case, Kaspersky approached NSA and the FBI to say that they had a problem. They had an employee who was downloading terabytes of information. How did that happen?
Well, Kaspersky didn't actually know that when they contacted the NSA. They didn't know that this contractor, Harold Martin, had 50 terabytes of government data in his home and car. All they knew was that there was something suspicious about him reaching out to them. So back in August 2016, on August 13, one researcher at Kaspersky received two messages from an account that was later connected to Martin. It was an anonymous account. They couldn't tell who it was initially. And it was a strange message because it started like as if they were in the middle of a conversation or they'd been talking previously. And it said, so think about arranging a conversation with Evgeny present. And Evgeny presumably refers to Eugene Kaspersky, who's the CEO of Kaspersky Lab. And then it was quickly followed up by a second message that said shelf life 3 weeks. So implying that whatever this person wanted to discuss had a limited window of opportunity for it. And that was it. The researcher didn't initially see the messages. It was a private direct message sent to them, but because the researcher didn't follow the account, it went into a request folder that you only see those messages if you actually click on the folder. And so the researcher didn't see it until 3 days later. But in the meantime, 30 minutes after those messages had come in, a group known as Shadow Brokers started posting classified NSA tools, hacking tools online. And so when the researcher saw the messages from this anonymous account 3 days later, combining that with the timing of when the messages came in, right before Shadow Brokers started leaking, and then with a little sleuthing, they discovered the identity of the sender of these messages, who they could tell was working in the intelligence community, that triggered an alarm for them that maybe this guy had some connection to the Shadow Brokers who were leaking NSA tools.
And that was the accusation at first. Was that ever proven?
So it never has been proven. So Harold Martin, when authorities got this information from Kaspersky, they obtained a warrant, search warrant for his Twitter account and his home. And when they got to his home, they found 50 terabytes estimated of classified data at his home and car. And he's only ever been charged, however, with 20 counts of unauthorized retention of government data. He's never been charged with espionage, which he would be if they had evidence that he had actually passed that information to anyone.
Right. And they were never able to specifically make the connection between Harold Martin and shadow brokers. Do you think it was a coincidence that this was happening within 30 minutes of one another, where Martin was sending the emails to Kaspersky and shadow brokers was making its threat?
The timing is so remarkable, it's hard to know, because, you know, life is strange, right? Reality is stranger than fiction. The timing of it is really bizarre. He doesn't offer them anything. He doesn't say he has anything in these messages to give them. And then as soon as the researcher, Kaspersky researcher, replied saying, do you have a PGP encryption key and email address that you want to chat over, the guy blocked him. And so researcher wasn't able to have further communication with him. So we don't really know what the intention of that correspondent was. A judge ruled that it was certainly suspicious, the timing of it and the nature of the message, that it warranted a search warrant. But, you know, there's a distant question of whether or not Martin actually sent those messages. I had tweeted something about this a couple of weeks ago, where I wondered idly if maybe his Twitter account had been hacked by shadow brokers. And to kill two birds with one stone, right? You start leaking government NSA tools, and then you could also sort of out an NSA worker at the same time. But we don't really know. And so far we have no evidence that his lawyer is taking that defense that he never sent the messages.
We also don't know why he had so much NSA classified information in his possession. I've heard it said that perhaps he was a hoarder, perhaps he had some kind of a mental illness, perhaps he was just a collector of classified information. Has he ever said, or has his attorney ever said, why he had retained so much information?
That's the defense so far that we've seen from court documents, is that he had an obsessive disorder that caused him to hoard. They called him a voracious reader and someone who was committed to excel at his job. And so the picture that they're painting, at least in the court documents, is that this is someone who simply was narrow-mindedly focused on learning a lot of information that was of interest to him without really thinking through the consequences of this. And you know, he did this for 20 years.
Right. He didn't do it overnight.
We're speaking with Kim Zetter. She's a journalist. She wrote this article in Politico. I want to quote a paragraph from your article, Kim, and then ask you to comment on it. It's a quote from Stuart Baker, general counsel for the NSA in the 1990s and a current partner at Steptoe and Johnson. He says, quote, "It's irony piled on irony that people who worked at Kaspersky, who were already in the sights of the U.S. intelligence community, disclosed to them that they had this problem," said Stuart Baker. "It's also discouraging," he noted, "that the NSA apparently still hasn't, quote, figured out a good way to find unreliable employees who are mishandling some of their most sensitive stuff," close quote. And then you finish with the quote, "We all thought Martin got caught by renewed or heightened scrutiny, and instead it looks as though he got caught because he was an idiot." Anyway, talk a little bit more about Stuart Baker's position here.
Well, he is the former general counsel of the NSA, but that was 2 decades ago. But he's in a position of having been in the intelligence community and specifically at the NSA to know, you know, the difficulties inside an organization like that, especially when you're dealing with contractors who come and go, how you can control them. It's a difficult position to be in because the government uses so many contractors. And so that means people who are coming in who are not necessarily committed for the long haul. And Martin worked in, you know, a lot of government offices and took data from all of them. So it wasn't just the NSA that suffered here. But it's clear that, you know, both the Snowden leaks and this, and there was another employee that was also caught taking home data to his computer. It's clear that the NSA and the government in general doesn't have a good handle on securing or even tracking. You know, it's one thing, you may not be able to prevent people from sort of initiating attempts to take data or even successfully, but if you don't have the ability to actually track what someone has done after the fact and know, then that's also a huge problem.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment on that too. I mentioned to Brian off the air that when I was at the CIA and Aldrich Ames was caught spying for the Russians, within weeks, literally every computer in the entire Central Intelligence Agency was swapped out for a new computer that had no external ports, right? No CD drives, DVD drives, no USB ports, nothing. You couldn't take anything out of those computers. I was shocked when I read your article and I saw that here we are in 2018, now 2019, and Martin could just download data and take it out. It was stunning to me.
Well, so, I mean, you have to look at sort of the errors there. I mean, at the time that you're talking about of changing computers that you have no way of extracting data from them, you know, a lot of work then was still done on paper, hard copy paper. Everything is done digitally now. The government is really widespread. They work with defense contractors. And so you're at odds here. You have this conflicting interest of security, but also the need to share data efficiently with a lot of different people. And that those two things conflict with each other, and they're hard to reconcile.
What do you think will happen now? We have about a minute left. I mean, when is the trial? What will happen to Martin? What's the defense? Where are you going with this story?
Well, the trial begins in June, but I doubt it will go to trial. These things generally plead out. There was an initial attempt by Martin to obtain a plea on by pleading guilty to just one charge, but that was rejected and or was withdrawn. And so currently, he, if nothing else happens between now and June, he will go to trial. And you know, I kind of hope he does, because there are a lot of unanswered questions here that will only be answered if he actually does go to trial and we see the prosecution's case against him.
I think that's exactly right. And this is an ongoing problem. For example, in the CIA torture case in Eastern Washington State, everybody wanted that case to go to trial just so we could see what was declassified and maybe get more of the story. I think Kim is exactly right. This likely will not go to trial. So we'll leave it there. We were joined from Oakland, California by the author of that exclusive article, Kim Zetter. She's a prolific journalist who has contributed to Politico, The Washington Post, The New York Times, CNN, NPR, and other outlets. And she's also the author of the book Countdown to Zero Day, Stuxnet and the Launch of the World's First Digital Weapon. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and we'll come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The New York Times today issued a correction, a retraction would be more appropriate, to a front page story yesterday saying that former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort had shared polling data with a Russian contact for passage to a Russian oligarch. That information was not true. Manafort had shared the information for passage to two Ukrainian politicians with whom he had had a business relationship. The true story undercuts any accusation of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who's the author of the book, The Plot to Control the World: How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
Dan, I couldn't find this correction on the front page of the New York Times today. I had to search for it, and of course it was buried. And just this one bit of information utterly undercuts the entire premise of yesterday's article.
And of course, John, you're looking, you can't find it. But
right.
Yesterday we did a show about this because this was the headline in so many print media and top story on electronic media, TV media, but not true.
Not true.
Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, well, this is kind of par for the course. I mean, you know, as we've been saying for many months now, the whole Russiagate scandal seems ginned up as a means to support, you know, continued aggression, not just against Russia, but against the rest of the world, Russia being the convenient scapegoat for the United States. And the New York Times has been one of the publications that has jumped on that bandwagon. And they jumped too quickly with this story, and now they've had to eat their words. But as you say, they did so quite sheepishly and tried to bury the story.
Actually, this correction was only two sentences, and here's what it says. An article on Wednesday about a court filing indicating that Paul Manafort shared polling data with a contact tied to Russian intelligence misidentified the people to whom Mr. Manafort wanted the contact to send the data. Mr. Manafort wanted the data sent to two Ukrainian oligarchs, Sergei Lyavachkin and Rinat Akhmetov, not to Oleg Deripaska, a Russian oligarch close to the Kremlin. I mean, this is what Manafort has been saying all along, that he had not been colluding with Deripaska. He had no political relationship with Deripaska. The New York Times yesterday called him a liar. And then today, buried somewhere in the corrections, they said, and by the way, Manafort was right and we were wrong.
Yeah, well, in the whole Manafort story, people need to remember, if they knew to begin with, that it has been about his connections not with Russia, but with Ukraine. And by the way, most of those connections having to do with trying to get Ukraine to be more friendly and more connected with the West, not to Russia. And my guess is these Ukrainian oligarchs, as they're being described, are people who are anti-Russian and not pro-Russian. And so the whole narrative starts to fall apart.
Yeah, that's right. Dan Kovalik is our guest. The other part of the story that's important for the audience, again, these are just headlines overwhelm the actual story, the actual facts. Facts, in a way, start to not matter because headlines dominate. But Deripaska, who yesterday we thought, because of the New York Times coverage and all the other media coverage, that Manafort was passing messages to a liaison to Deripaska, and Deripaska's close to Putin, and then because X equals Y and Y equals Z, we have a connection between Manafort and Putin, right? That's the story. But who is Deripaska to start with? Deripaska is a billionaire. He's one of the biggest oligarchs, capitalists in Russia. And they always talk about him, John, as if he's real, real close to Vladimir Putin. I want to read an article from The Telegraph, UK's media. This is from 10 years ago, from 2009. Vladimir Putin takes Oleg Deripaska to task. That's the headline. And I want to read a couple sentences to you. Mr. Putin, who is a master at dispensing ritual humiliation, likened Oleg Deripaska to a cockroach and forced him to accompany him on a tour of Pikhlevo, a factory town that has witnessed the most serious social unrest Russia has seen since the start of the global economic crisis. Last week, Pikhlevo's residents vented their anger over job losses and unpaid wages at one of the oligarchs, that's Deripaska's, local factories by blocking a major road and causing a 250-mile traffic jam. So Putin goes there to this factory town where Deripaska is closing the factory. The workers are closing down the roads, 250-mile traffic jam. Putin likens Deripaska to a cockroach and says, guess what, Oleg, open this factory or we're going to come after you. And Deripaska decides to keep the factory open so that the workers don't lose their job. Now, that's not a friendship. That's not a relationship of great, you know, warmth and embrace. Deripaska is a businessman doing business in Russia. Putin was trying to rein in the oligarchs who had the run of the place in the 1990s. That's actually what's going on. But it doesn't matter, again, Dan, as long as Oleg Deripaska is a Russian and has any connection, because he's a Russian businessman or billionaire, with anything that has to do with the Russian government, he's automatically a friend of Putin's. Also not true.
Yeah, well, you know, you've said a lot there. So first of all, yes, they treat Russia as if it's a small town, right? As if all Russians are the same and all Russians know each other. It's a country, I think, with 11 time zones. It's gigantic, you know, to try to lump all these Russians in together. And by the way, there's a lot of ethnicities beyond Russians in Russia as well. But to lump them all together is just, it's infantile. And it's also insulting, by the way. We would never accept that in the United States or for the U.S. folks to be characterized that way. But you mentioned something else. You know, you mentioned how the oligarchs had their run of the place in the 1990s. Of course, the irony is these oligarchs that are now being so pilloried by the U.S. press were being supported by the press.
That's right.
In the 1990s.
Yeah, that's right.
The New York Times of the world supported Yeltsin, who sold the entire country, or more accurately, gave the entire country away to Russian and, by the way, United States oligarchs. And yet now these are people who we are supposed to fear.
Again, I want our audience to actually go to the New York Times. It's really remarkable that after this dominating story, front page everywhere, the correction, as you mentioned, John, it's like tiny.
Yeah.
An article on Wednesday about a court filing indicating that Paul Manafort shared polling data. It didn't indicate. It said it categorically.
Yes.
It said it with blaring headlines. And so no one's going to see the corrections. They're only going to see yesterday's headlines. You and I can go out into the street. We can even go talk, John, to people we know, people who might read the New York Times. And if we told them, oh, by the way, that story about Deripaska and Manafort wasn't true, all of it's BS, they will say, what?
Yeah, they wouldn't know what we were talking about.
Because they won't read this correction. The correction should have been equal in its headline size. We were wrong, or we lied to you. That should have been the headline. Again, about Russia. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, well, in fact, in a libel case, for example, that would be the remedy. You know, if you libel someone, and by the way, they did. They did libel Manafort. As a remedy, you are supposed to do exactly what you said. You're supposed to make the correction on the untruth you told in the same way you told the untruth. So again, so people can find it out. And so the record can be truly corrected. But here, they made no effort to correct the record in a real way. And why? Because it goes against the narrative that the New York Times itself has been ginning up now for many, many months.
You know, I'm anxious to see, too, what other outlets across the country picked up that New York Times article and then did not publish a correction today. Because you know that happened.
Yeah, they might not have even seen it to publish it.
Right, they may not have even seen it. That's right.
I'm looking at other articles because it was treated as true, an indication that Manafort, who had been for a brief time Trump's campaign chairman in 2016, that showed the Russian collusion with Trump. So Trump didn't know that it wasn't true either. So if you look at the other headlines from yesterday, Trump says he knew nothing about Manafort sharing polling data with Russians. That's from the Washington Post. This is from The Hill. Trump denies knowing Manafort shared polling data with Russians. CNBC, Trump, colon, I knew nothing about Manafort sharing polling data with the alleged blah, blah, blah. The reason Trump didn't know about it is that it didn't happen. And so here you had a story that was not true, that was asserted to be absolutely categorically true as proof of collusion. And there's Trump who says Manafort might have done it, but I didn't know about it. But in fact, Manafort didn't know it. And again, this correction comes a day too late.
That's right. We will have to leave it there. We were joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. Dan's a human rights and labor lawyer who's the author of the new book, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
It's time again for our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. We're joined from California by Jerry Condon. He's a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who's been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, currently as national president of Veterans for Peace. Welcome back, Jerry.
Glad to be here.
Jerry, one of the issues that has just changed and morphed and moved all over the place in the last week or two is this debate over the pullout of U.S. troops from both Syria and Afghanistan. The troops are going to be withdrawn. The troops are not going to be withdrawn. Or they will be withdrawn because ISIS is defeated, or they won't be withdrawn because ISIS is not defeated. Let's start by talking about that.
Yeah, well, it's really disappointing to those of us who saw a little glimmer of hope there and think maybe President Trump's going to do the right thing. It makes you wonder, like, who is actually in charge? The president, supposedly the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, he announces he will quickly withdraw U.S. troops from Syria, which would be a great thing to do. And he gets incredible pushback from pretty much the entire establishment, the Pentagon, the State Department, his own security advisor, Democrats and Republicans, the mainstream media, you know, apparently they all think it's a good idea for the U.S. to maintain U.S. troops in Syria. For what? You know, even some progressives, I think, are confused because Trump is so hated and mistrusted and seen as incompetent. So when he calls for an end to some of these wars, even the peace movement doesn't know whether to trust him or his motives. You know, well, you know, in Veterans for Peace, we don't trust Trump or his motives, but we continue to call for an end to all of these wars, which have been total failures, first of all, they're wrong and immoral, illegal. They've failed to achieve any of the supposed U.S. goals. They've killed millions of innocent human beings. They should end.
Yeah, Jerry's absolutely right. U.S. troops are in Syria, and as we keep repeating, but we don't mind repeating because, you know, repetition is necessary. When you turn on the corporate-owned mainstream media, all you get is repetition. It's the same line over and over and over again. Trump is doing something terrible now. Why? Because he said he wanted to bring U.S. troops out of Syria. We made the point. Not only is it wrong politically, not only is it wrong ethically, not only is it wrong morally, not only is it wrong in so many other ways that you could ascribe to, like, the human condition or what human beings should be thinking or believing. It's also not legal. It's not legal because the Syrian government is a government and it has sovereign control over its territory, presumably according to international law. It's not invited. The United States is not invited to be there. The other entity that could make it legal would be the UN Security Council. The UN Security Council has not adopted a resolution authorizing U.S. troops to be in Syria. And Syria is not attacking the United States, which would be the third grounds for a legal intervention in Syria, because Syria obviously is not posing a threat. So in all ways, it's illegal. And as a consequence, it's surprising, Jerry Condon, that people who traditionally have said, bring the troops home from Iraq, or who have generally opposed war, are now treating this, because it's Donald Trump doing it, as if it's some grave threat to the national, an existential threat to America and American policy.
All right. Well, you do hear those voices, but I'm happy to say that not too many people in the peace movement have been fooled. I mean, I think we had really strong statements coming out from Veterans for Peace, from Code Pink, from the United National Anti-War Coalition, and others who were, you know, very much in support of withdrawing the troops. And they said, you know, whatever reasons Trump is doing it, it's the right thing to do. We want it to continue. But, you know, you wonder if Trump is painting himself as an anti-interventionist who wants to end these wars. And he has made many statements from the time he was campaigning through until now that he thinks we're overextended. He recently said that the U.S. is, you know, at war and more in countries that most Americans have never even heard of, and he said that that's ridiculous. I got to agree with him there. But then why would he appoint people like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, who are known as war hawks, who were lusting to go to war with Iran? Why would he appoint them to be his key foreign policy people?
And they disagree with each other constantly. And today's Washington Post said that Trump constantly calls Bolton Mike. He's confusing the two of them, that he calls him Mike all day long.
But, you know, the one thing, though, is regarding Iran, Bolton and Pompeo have the same position as Trump, which is this hardline anti-Iran position.
When it comes down to it, that's it.
Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was the worst deal ever. That's the Iran nuclear arms deal. It's really about U.S. troop engagement in Syria. You know, most politicians, Jerry Condon, would be worried that if they pull the U.S. troops out of Syria, they'll be admitting that the U.S. lost in its aspirations in Syria. And as a consequence, they don't want to take responsibility for the perception of defeat. That's what kind of drove Nixon and Kissinger to keep fighting for four more years in a war that was obviously not winnable. That was the Vietnam War. Maybe another million Vietnamese died, 30,000 more Americans died, hundreds of thousands more were harmed. Trump, in this case, didn't seem to care, but he's surrounded by people who are telling him, you absolutely can't do this. In a way, it seems like even though the president is the, quote, commander-in-chief, the way the military-industrial complex works in America, the president is just one of many voices, and the other voices are all committed to these kinds of foreign wars.
Right. And none of these guys give a damn about the so-called U.S. troops that they're always praising. Support the troops, support the troops. But they're putting the troops into multiple deployments in unwinnable wars where they have enemies on all sides and they're making new enemies on a daily basis. It's been well established that the U.S. presence in the Middle East is creating terrorism as opposed to fighting terrorism. Well, sometimes actually actively aiding and abetting terrorism as it has done in Syria. So, you know, these troops are coming back from 3, 4, 5 deployments to these wars. And with each additional deployment, they are more likely to be very, very damaged when they return.
Yeah.
If not with physical wounds, then definitely with psychological wounds, PTSD, TBI, traumatic brain injury from being exposed to explosions, and also what we call moral injury, because they come to realize that they actually killed people on behalf of a cause that was based on lies. And that's very, very hard thing for people to deal with. That's one of the reasons we have a suicide rate now that's 22, 23 active duty and veterans every single day of the year. Can you imagine that? So that's what they're doing to these troops by keeping them in these totally untenable, ridiculous, and horrible, unwinnable wars.
You know, John Bolton, by the way, like George W. Bush and so many others, he joined the Maryland Army National Guard in 1970, so he wouldn't be possibly conscripted through the Selective Service. Of course, that was a way of avoiding the war in Vietnam. George W. Bush did the same thing, except he didn't even show up for duty because he was probably too drunk most of the time. And of course, Donald Trump, based on the recommendation, the diagnosis of a podiatrist who lived or whose office is in his father's, Fred Trump's, building, he couldn't go into to the military because he had bone spurs, although later when asked, he couldn't remember what foot it was for. Again, Jerry, these guys they love veterans. They denounce anybody who takes a knee. They say you're dishonoring veterans if you protest police brutality, blah, blah, blah. They don't go. They don't go at all. They are not in harm's way.
No, not at all. But, you know, Brian, I do think that there is, nonetheless, despite all this back and forth and hypocrisy, and I think there is nonetheless a glimmer of hope that we see going into the beginning of 2019, that the U.S. policy in Middle East is clearly in disarray. There are clearly confusion within the ruling circles about, you know, what to do about Syria, what to do about Iraq, what to do about Afghanistan and Yemen. There's a lot of pushback in the Senate now, and I think also in the House, wanting to end U.S. involvement with the Saudi-led massacre in Yemen. So these are signs that we should look to with a certain amount of hope and motivation for the peace movement to really step up its game. This is the year where we need to make a really strong push to finally end these so-called forever wars.
Yeah, Jerry, we have 1 minute left. Again, Donald Trump has sent the troops to the U.S.-Mexican border, now about to declare a national emergency. I know VFP has done a lot of work in the opposition to Trump's plans. 60 seconds, take us out with what you're doing and what your view is on all this.
Yeah, well, you know, it's another war based on lies, but one that's on our own border, and we're very concerned about it. I know that Veterans for Peace is going to be participating in protests here in San Diego, where I am today. Tomorrow and Saturday, there's going to be protests. There's a pretty large coalition here called the Migrant and Refugee Solidarity Coalition. Many different groups involved are going to be protesting against ICE, against Customs and Border Patrol, and against Department of Homeland Security in downtown San Diego tomorrow afternoon, and then on Saturday at the border again. And at the same time, you know, we talked in recent shows about our deported veterans over on the other side in Tijuana are expressing a lot of solidarity and helping out with humanitarian aid for the Central America caravan of asylum seekers there. So we're continuing that work. In fact, we're making a statement by having our first board of directors meeting for Veterans for Peace this year is going to be in Tijuana at the end of this month to show make it very clear our solid support for our deported veterans and for the asylum seekers and for a just U.S. immigration policy and force our government to follow its own laws and international law to give justice to these asylum seekers.
We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from California by Jerry Condon. Jerry's a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who has been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, currently as national president of Veterans for Peace. This is Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The UK's departure from the European Union is fast approaching. The British Parliament is now conducting the official debate on the Brexit deal ahead of a vote next week. But Prime Minister Theresa May not have the votes necessary to pass the terms of the deal, and she was dealt a blow when members of her own Conservative Party revolted to help pass a motion limiting her options in the event that the deal is rejected. We're joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Welcome back, Alexander.
Delighted to be with you again.
Alexander, if this was possible, it's gotten even more complicated in the last week or 10 days than it was before. Can you walk us through the developments of the last week or so?
Yes. I think the first thing to understand is that, of course, the deal which Theresa May is now going to present to the British Parliament next week is essentially, in all essentials, the same deal that she tried to present back in December, and which it was very clear would not be passed then, and which she therefore postponed the vote on in order to renegotiate with the European Union. She did try to renegotiate the deal with the European Union, but it's clear that has got nowhere at all, and it is very difficult to see how a deal which was unacceptable in December to the British Parliament is going to become acceptable to the British Parliament now. The deal doesn't satisfy those who want to leave the European Union fully, because it attaches Britain in a customs union arrangement with the European Union, which only the European Union can end because of this issue of the Irish border. And, of course, it doesn't satisfy the anti-Brexit group within the British Parliament, who basically don't want any sort of exit at all, and certainly not on the terms that Theresa May is proposing. Now, what has happened over the last few days is that as she has gradually approaching this vote next week, the anti-Brexit majority in the House of Commons has started to assert itself. It is trying to box her in to prevent, they say, a no-deal Brexit. That is a situation where Britain crashes out of the European Union on the 29th of March without any agreement in place. It has succeeded in winning two votes against her with the support of around 20 Conservative MPs who essentially represent the pro-EU element within the British Conservative Party, and critically with the support of the Speaker of the House of Commons, who is the chairman of the House of Commons, who is supposed to be impartial, but who is clearly of an anti-Brexit position, and who is now effectively bending or remaking the parliamentary rules to allow the parliamentary majority to start dictating the position to Theresa May. So her options are narrowing. She looks certain to lose the vote next week. What happens after is very unclear, but it looks as if the anti-Brexit majority in the House of Commons, in the British Parliament, is starting to assert itself and may be gaining more control.
Well, let me ask you about that. I'm looking at a poll that was conducted over the last few days and is published in Bloomberg, and it says that, well, on the date of the Brexit vote, the final vote was 52% to leave, 48% to remain. That has flipped now. As of this week, it's 53% remain and 47% leave, and Theresa May's approval rating is down to 24%. So let me ask you about the possibilities of two things. One is that the vote fails and there's either a referendum, a new referendum, or Parliament decides this isn't worth the trouble and they elect to not leave. Or number two, the government collapses because of the vote and new elections will have to be called.
Right. Now, let's take those three in turn. The first is the Parliament simply cancels Brexit and decides that Britain remains a fully fledged member of the European Union. I don't think there is any possibility whatsoever of that happening. That would mean cancelling the Brexit referendum of 2016. I think that is too radical a step. I think what the anti-Brexit majority in the House of Commons would prefer to see is a second referendum in which they gamble that opinion poll, which you quoted, is correct, and that Britain this time votes to stay in the European Union. I think there are many, many risks with that approach. I think that it's important to remember that before the 2016 referendum, it seemed as if the anti-Brexit position had the majority. What it suggests to me is that opinion in the country remains very evenly divided, and there are serious risks that if you go for a second referendum, that could polarize the country even further, with many people feeling very angry at having to go through the whole thing all over again. But that may be where we are heading, because it is the only realistic way that Brexit can be stopped. The third possibility of the government collapsing, I think, is a very real one. I think if we see the vote fail next week, and I think if it looks as if Theresa May is then going to push for a no-deal Brexit, that is to say, a Brexit with Britain crashing out of the European Union, it is possible that we could see a party split, the Conservative Party split. The 20 Conservative MPs who have up to now been voting with Theresa May on confidence issues, but which are opposed to her and opposed to her Brexit approach, and who think that a no-deal Brexit is a disaster for Britain, they may feel themselves under great personal pressure to support a new election in that situation, which might reopen the whole issue of how Brexit is going to be done, with a new government, presumably led by Jeremy Corbyn, taking the matter forward, asking the EU for a delay, and then trying to renegotiate the terms. So that is a real possibility, but at this moment in time, nothing is clear.
Alexander Makouris is our guest. Alexander is the editor-in-chief of the Duran. We have about 4 minutes left, Alexander. Time goes so fast here. Okay, let's just go to that last option. The no Brexit deal is unacceptable. The government collapses. General elections are held. Jeremy Corbyn is calling for general elections and said the confusion and the chaos that exists right now can't really be resolved through the current process, that there needs to be a general election. Right now, Jeremy Corbyn has a lot of support. He's overcome the Blairite wing of the parliamentary wing of the Labour Party, which, you know, tried to sink him as the Labour leader. And Jeremy Corbyn is a leftist. He's a socialist. He's been the same Jeremy Corbyn for the last five decades. In other words, true to his own convictions and beliefs. He's not a standard traditional politician. Assuming the position of prime minister under these circumstances also would seem to me to be very, very complicated for somebody like Jeremy Corbyn. What's your take on that?
It will be hugely complicated. But first of all, can I just say, if the government collapses in that way, his position does look very strong, because it would be a collapse of the government, because the government's Brexit strategy has been seen to fail. There would be a party split, and it's very difficult to see the Conservative Party fighting an effective campaign in the face of a party split. And, of course, Theresa May has said that she will not lead the Conservative Party in the event of a new election. So it's not easy to see who would be leading the Conservatives in that position. Frankly, I think if that happens, if we have an election, the likelihood is that we would have Labour win, probably with a substantial majority, in which case Jeremy Corbyn's position might actually be quite strong. He would have to face continued opposition from within the Labour Party, the Parliamentary Labour Party, which remains heavily Blairite. He would face opposition from the media, which is almost united in its hostility to him, and, of course, from the business community, and, if you like, from what one might call the British deep state, which does exist, the intelligence and security services and the rest. But, in a sense, his position would be that he is the only option available. He would be the only person who would be able to continue the government of Britain in accordance with the well-established British constitutional principle that the Queen's government must be carried on. And that would put him, I think, in a position of considerable strength.
That would be truly a remarkable development. I have to say, I mean, the UK and the United States principal parties for empire, and here is Jeremy Corbyn anti-empire. Again, I've mentioned this before, John. As an organizer, as the national director of the Answer Coalition, we invited Jeremy Corbyn to participate in our demonstration on January 18, 2003, a demo of about 500,000 people here in Washington against the Iraq war, trying with the slogan, stop the war before it starts. Almost no U.S. politician showed up, but
guess what?
Jeremy Corbyn, at his own cost, came all the way from the U.K. He spoke. That's Jeremy Corbyn.
It is indeed. And can I just say, of course, that explains why so many people oppose him, but it also explains why so many people support him. It is because he has worked so hard for decades, year after year, fighting this lonely battle. He's a very well-known politician in Britain. People don't realize this. He was already well-known before he became Labour leader, and he was known for being precisely that sort of person. That is why he was elected leader of the Labour Party. That is why he is in a strong position now. It is because, if you like, his time may be coming. And, of course, that happens in British politics.
It has. Really, really interesting.
We'll have to leave it there. We were joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. Love, love, love.